You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Squatter of Point Doom by Bradley Hope and Tom Wright. After Alden was allegedly locked out of his apartment, Mindy vowed to fight McNulty in court. At one point, she says, McNulty offered through an intermediary to leave if she were paid $20,000. She figures out you hate her so much. You're afraid of her. You want to get rid of her. You don't want to go to court. You don't want those months of your life tormented, torture, and everything she knows she's subjecting you to. So she'll hope you're going to pay to just get her out, she says. This time, though, McNulty's gambit didn't work. She knew that Alden had the backing of me, who was unrelenting, and his brother, and that she was going to see us in court. And she knew that we had a pretty good case, Mindy says. McNulty had also made a misstep. She'd ask for the $20,000 from the Marins as a way to pay a deposit on her next place, a property just east of Point Doom near Barbara Streisand's mansion, according to Mindy. She'd provided the banking details of the owner, a retired schoolteacher. And the agreement is she's got her next grift lined up, like the poor schoolteacher that we unearthed because she was stupid enough to give me the bank information because she was starting to panic, Mindy says. Instead of paying her to vacate Alden's place, Mindy decided to pass a warning to the prospective landlord about McNulty. She never moved in. In early 2022, the Marins went to court in Los Angeles. Alden was shaking in his boots, his sister says. At one point, according to Mindy, McNulty stepped into an elevator with them and proceeded to pursue the family around the courthouse. She tried to follow us through stairwells on different floors. We had to wait in a parking garage, she says. It was nuts. Eventually, a judge ordered McNulty to vacate the premises. They threw the book at her, Mindy says, but somehow she must be staying somewhere right now. For all we know, she's got a new victim. By the end of last year, McNulty's whereabouts were unknown. She'd been spotted a few times in Point Doom's shopping center. A manager at Le Café de la Plage, Malibu, said she'd been banned for harassing customers for free coffee. A security guard for the shopping complex said he'd been told to keep an eye on her. She was making fewer appearances at the cafe or the nearby Pavilion's supermarket, and she wasn't seen much on the beaches either. And so we sent her a text. Hi, is this Ellie? Hi, yes, this is Ellie, came the reply. Please, could you remind me where, how we met? At first, she was cordial, sensing, perhaps, that there was something to gain from the interaction. But after it became clear she was the subject of an investigative report about her disputes with landlords, McNulty obfuscated. She declined to meet or answer questions. Eventually, she wrote, "We don't retaliate, and we don't denounce anyone, so I'll let the sweet truth triumph in the end. Thank you." Later, we sent a detailed list of questions. She never responded. One day in November 2023, just as it was finally starting to turn cold in Point Doom, McNulty reappeared on the doorstep of Marwa, the retired dentist, to the stars, asking for more money. Marwa says he declined and told her not to come back. Lately, she's been posting photographs from Escondido Beach, just east of Point Doom. As for Alden, he was discharged from the hospital and moved to a new place because he didn't feel safe in the old condo. He was terrified of her after she left, Mindy says. He would see her all the time, and it was awful for him. After bumping into McNulty one too many times around town and on the beach, Alden finally moved out of Malibu and allowed his family to sell the condo. But life is not the same. He's just not himself. And any of his friends would tell you that. Like, oh my God, what happened to Alden? A killer view. When an heiress to the L.L. Bean fortune noticed that a grove of majestic oaks on her coastal Maine property had died, she cast her suspicions on her neighbors uphill. Summer residents who wanted a better view of Camden Harbor. The legal fight that ensued became a town drama that roils to this day, by Keziah Weir. Opening photo, knock wood, an aerial view of Lisa Gorman's house in the foreground and Amelia and Arthur Bond's house behind it, divided by a stand of dead trees. Knox County, Camden, Maine. In summer, beech roses tumble over dry stone walls, and the long lupine spines streak roadsides and garden beds with purple. on certain winter days when the temperature's right, sea smoke, a vaporous ghostly fog, rises from the harbor. The craggy face of Mount Batty looms to the north. On the cover of Camden's 2024 annual report, available for passers-by at the town office, the town slogan, "Where the mountains meet the sea." For visitors, Camden might be a stop along U.S. Route 1, called the Coastal Highway, though it only briefly kisses the water. What the drive on U.S. Route 1 lacks in actual coastline, it makes up for in dense stretches of trees, various rock and mineral shops, excellent thrift stores, and the Taste of Maine restaurant, almost impossible to miss. Given that the world's largest inflatable lobster, a 700-pound behemoth named Larry, sprawls across its roof. Once you see Larry, you're about an hour out. In Camden, you'll find a town of tidy colonials and Cape Cods and bungalow cottages with names like Shamrocks and Millstones. After a fire decimated 40 buildings on the main drag during the shipbuilding boom back in 1892, business owners got together and decided to remake the district in brick, rendering it more fire-resistant and perfectly picturesque. When it came time to choose a filming location for 1957's Peyton Place, a story of gossip and violence roiling against a backdrop of New England charm, the filmmakers chose Camden. Today, thanks in part to a local ordinance, even the Walgreens sign is quaint, its logo rendered not in the usual oversized red plastic, but instead in a tasteful, unassuming gold on black. The population is just above 5,000, and there are a little more than three times as many registered Democrats as there are Republicans. For the 2020 census, 93% of residents are white. It's a year-round town, locals will be quick to tell you, not like Bar Harbor. Most of the businesses stay open for the winter, kept afloat by full-time residents and visitors to the Camden Snow Bowl, which houses a 400-foot wooden chute that allows many toboggans to reach speeds of up to 40 miles per hour, according to the website. And, more notably, in a town that prizes the expanse of its harbor above much else, it is also the only ski area on the East Coast with ocean views. Less than a mile from the town center, Lisa Gorman's two-story cedar-shingled vacation home nestles on a low bluff above the Atlantic, with floor-to-ceiling windows offering an unobstructed panorama of Camden Harbor and a set of private steps winding down to a public beach. Native oaks, spruces, and hemlocks encircle the property at 3 Metcalf Road, which covers a little over half an acre and abuts two neighboring plots. It's a prime spot in a rarefied neighborhood, one befitting the 74-year-old widow of the chairman emeritus of L.L. Bean. The town's median income is about $91,000, and its median home price hovers around $800,000. Down the street from Gorman, a five-bedroom waterfront property is listed for just shy of $4.5 million, and her own home is valued at $5 million. Her neighbors include John Reed, the former CEO of Citigroup and chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, and at least one heir to the IBM Watson fortune. Sometime in the spring of 2022, a caretaker noticed that several of the trees on Gorman's property were ailing. Leaves withered, turning yellow and brown. The failing trees were along the property line that divided Gorman's house from her uphill neighbors at 1 Metcalf Road, Amelia and Arthur Bond, both in their mid-60s. In May, Gorman's landscapers arrived to suss out the scene. The crew found themselves working in close proximity to another team of landscapers, not unusual in a town where gardening, as one local said, is blood sport, contracted by the Bonds. The unusual thing was that, according to a document written by Gorman's lawyer and sent to the town of Camden, Her guys found Abond's guys putting ladders on Gorman's trees, as if they were preparing to cut them down. Gorman's team ran them off, but shortly thereafter, Gorman noticed that more than a dozen appeared to be missing their tops. In mid-June, according to the same document, Amelia Bond told Gorman that her trees did not look good. There was apparently some mention of brown-tail moths, seasonal pest that had become a particular nuisance in Camden in recent years. The caterpillars have tiny noxious hairs that can cause a poison ivy-esque rash and feed on oaks like the ones languishing on Gorman's property. Amelia Bond made a neighborly suggestion that she and Gorman split the cost of removing the trees. But Gorman had been treating her trees for brown-tail moths, and her landscapers thought the damage looked more like a symptom of herbicide. It so happened that the trees featured prominently in the view from the Bond's bay-facing windows. Gorman declined the unbelievably generous offer. Instead, in July, Gorman contracted Bartlett tree experts to take tissue samples. The samples came back positive for dibithrarion, a broad-spectrum herbicide indicated to kill woody and herbaceous plants at industrial and large-scale sites like airports, highways, and grazing pastures. On Gorman's property, the herbicide had seemingly affected more than 80 trees, bushes, and shrubs, maples, blueberry bushes, dogwoods, and seven mature oaks that towered over the houses, ranging from 39 to 77 feet high. The flora was unsalvageable and would need to be removed. And because of the nature of the herbicide, which is resistant to degradation and disperses via groundwater, the soil would have to go too. In October, Gorman's lawyer, Daniel Nutzi, contacted the office of Camden's Planning and Development Director, Jeremy Martin. "Hey, can you meet me on the site?" Martin remembers the lawyer saying. "We got a problem." Martin, who, among other things, oversees the town's shoreland zoning, visited the site, took a look at the affected trees, and in turn brought the issue to the Camden Select Board. And just like that, the neighborly dispute became a matter of public record, spiraling into a saga that has dredged up existential anxieties and disparate personal tragedies, and that now, more than 2 years later, remains unresolved. Camden operates under a select board town manager form of government, the last holdout in the experiment of direct democracy that began in New England nearly 400 years ago, as current board member Allison McKellar wrote in her first campaign letter, published in the local outlet The Penobscot Bay Pilot in 2017. An elected 5-member select board serves as the executive branch, while a board-appointed town manager handles daily administrative duties. At the state and federal level, we have a republic, not a democracy, and this is the system we teach in schools, she wrote. Not so in Camden. The select board gets to choose a town manager, but citizens must vote on budgets, ordinances, and many contracts and policies that the town adopts. 7 years into her tenure, she adds to me, we are very much a complaint-based system. McKellar, born and raised in town, is 40 years old, with the streaked blonde hair of a camp counselor and a wry sense of humor. Brown-tail moths or no, you can't decide to put your neighbor's trees out of their misery, she said, with droll exasperation during one select board meeting, by poisoning them. Her longtime cause celeb has been lobbying for the demolition of the town's controversial 200-year-old Montgomery Dam, an attractive relic that, following a 2021 study, environmental consultants advised should be removed. Her Instagram offers views of Camden, typically reserved for the fish and the birds, drone shots of the harbor, underwater videos of trout and elvers in the McGuntacook River. In the name of participatory democracy, every 2 weeks, McKellar spends up to 4 hours in the bowels of the Camden Opera House, which homes the town office, with her fellow board members and the town manager, discussing and codifying issues ranging from marijuana licensing ordinances to solid waste disposal in town and the potential purchase of a new groomer for the Snowball. For their trouble, board members make $2,000 a year. It was Gorman's complaint to Martin's office, McKellar says, that triggered the select board's involvement in the herbiciding. If you're going to take somebody to court, you can send a notice of violation without the select board, but if you want to follow up, namely with enforcement action, they need us. Martin fields grievances about anything under the sun, he says, with not a little weariness, when I meet him at the town office. Their tree, their vegetation, their drainage from their property is causing a problem on my property, is how he describes the scope. More often than not, he determines these to be civil matters rather than code violations. But following his visit to the site of the poisoning, Martin consulted with the Maine Department of Environmental Protection Shoreland Zoning Coordinator on the relevant ordinance. It deals with aesthetics, erosion, water quality, those kinds of things, he says. In allegedly applying the herbicide that killed the trees, Amelia Bond had breached an ordinance. A fact Martin delivered on November 28, 2022, via a letter emblazoned with the town seal and notice of violation in large type. It came to the attention of the Camden Code and Planning Office that an herbicide was used by you or an agent of yours to defoliate and kill numerous woody trees and plants on land not owned by you at 3 Metcalf Road, Martin wrote. The town of Camden is alarmed at such blatant disregard for the environment and for the abutters' property and in such close proximity to the Atlantic Ocean. Martin gave a copy of the letter to the select board, which kicked off the first of multiple discussions. The board, whose members serve staggered 3-year terms, can be a place for fierce disagreement. But on the herbicide, board member Tom Hellstrom tells me that the issue prompted the most unifying response that we've ever had. The premeditation is really shocking, because people can make mistakes, right? Says Hellstrom, an electrician, and when we speak, first-term chairman of the Camden Select Board, which makes him as close to a mayor as an elected official in Camden's government can get. But this was the tale that was told, and it's not really in dispute, is that the Bonds went and put this poison on the Gorman's trees, on their property. And then 6 months or a year later, when these mature oaks... And oaks are rugged. You have to really put something on. Roundup isn't going to kill an oak. When the trees started to die, they called up Ms. Gorman, and they asked her for a meeting. And they went out there, and they said, boy, these trees really look rough. You really ought to cut them down. Never once indicating in any way that they were the ones who had killed the trees. I mean, that type of premeditation? That is not something that most people are capable of, I believe. The violation notice and initial select board meeting merited the first piece of news on the issue, published by the Penobscot Bay Pilot. What was that siren, and why were the cops driving like bats out of hell, reads a self-description on the site. How did the town vote last night, and what is its significance? Is it a snow day today? Linda Clancy, the pilot's founding director, would go on to write nearly a dozen articles, thoroughly cataloging the case as it wended its way through various government agencies. After issuing the violation notice, it took a long time to work with the Bonds, Martin says. There's a significant amount of money involved, and you had two parties that were in negotiations, too. We're a third party in the middle of it. We kind of let their issues play out, their settlement play out. The settlement played out. According to a letter that the Bond's lawyer sent to Martin in December, Amelia Bond believes that she applied a product called Alligare, the brand name for the chemical Tebutherion, which she bought in a 4-pound bag in Missouri, to dead and or dying oak trees on the border of the Bond property. According to Nutzi's letter to the town of Camden, Arthur Bond admitted to having cut the trees to improve their view of the harbor. By May 2023, crews had begun excavation and remediation of the site. A seasoned arborist felled the trees. A pair of backhoes stripped the soil. The whole mess was handled as hazardous waste and schlepped to the Juniper Ridge landfill in Old Town. By July, to cover the cost, Gorman and the Bonds had come to a private settlement of $1.58 million, just a couple $100,000 shy of what the Bonds paid for their house in 2018. But the town's fight had just begun. "I've worked in local government for 16 years, says Audra Kaler, Camden's town manager since 2017. "I've never seen a community that prides itself and treasures stewardship of the environment, particularly trees, the way that Camden does. So it's just kind of a shocking misalignment with the values of the community to have somebody intentionally poison trees. The oaks in particular elicited public sympathy and imagination. In Maine, oak trees have been medicine, as used by Wabanaki tribes, and building material for furniture, the ribs and beams of ships, lobster trap runners. With their wide canopies and dense broad trunks, oaks can capture more than 48 pounds of carbon per year, while their vast shallow root systems are excellent at managing watershed. They host about 430 moth and butterfly species, according to Kate Garland, a horticulturist at the University of Maine, and support a complex food web. The National Wildlife Federation describes the species as the tree of life. When another oak, located in Late Park, just yards away from Gorman's property, came down during Tropical Storm Lee, someone left mums at its base, and news of its demise appeared in two local papers. In October 2023, the town of Camden settled with the Bonds for $210,000 in fines for the zoning violations, plus $30,700 so that the consultancy firm Seve & Meyer Engineers could begin monitoring the nearby Late Beach and Park to determine whether the herbicide had seeped onto public land. They were doing somersaults to try to figure out how to get these people on something, McKellar says. The Shoreland violation was creative, and it worked fine, but it's also the type of thing that rich people get accused of doing. It's like a high society kind of thing that's not as embarrassing as being charged with criminal trespassing, vandalism, that kind of stuff. The Bonds were very cooperative, Martin says. I mean, why wouldn't you cooperate, especially when in the letter that you sent from the attorney, you indicated that Mrs. Bond did this? Whether the Bonds were cooperative or not, following an insider tip, the Daily Mail picked up the story. Dozens of other articles followed, including in the Portland Press Herald, New York Post, the Boston Globe, and the Associated Press, for which it became among the AP's top 25 stories globally and the most engaged story of the week for U.S. News. The story told is one of a respected local victimized by nefarious newcomers. As David Sharp wrote for the AP, if this were a made-for-TV drama, the story set against the backdrop of this quaint village would have it all, replete with wealthy out-of-state villains and a sleuthing member of the venerable L.L. Bean family. Gorman's husband didn't just lead the Heritage brand, he was the founder's grandson. In the articles, the Bonds, who have declined to be interviewed for prior reporting and this article, instead of submitting statements via their lawyer, are ciphers. Amelia Bond was an investment banker who went on to head the St. Louis Community Foundation for 12 years, but retired amid the tree brouhaha. Arthur Bond III is an architect and the nephew of Christopher Kit Bond, the former longtime Republican senator from Missouri, whose Wikipedia page flags his exceptionally low rating from the environmental watchdog group Republicans for Environmental Protection. His consistent attempts to ban same-sex marriage, and his infamous comparison of waterboarding to swimming. There are different ways of doing it, freestyle, freestyle, backstroke. Reporters often noted that Arthur and Amelia Bond were members of the Camden Yacht Club until a certain point in the news cycle when they began to report that they weren't, the thinking being that they had either been kicked out or left in disgrace. In July, Camden Yacht Club director Colleen Dugan confirmed that the Bonds were not members, but declined to comment further. Almost none of the Camden locals I spoke to for this story knew them. Most had never seen them around, had maybe clocked their car coming or going, though not since the story made its way to the press. People mentioned the yacht club, the golf club, MAGA. The Bonds and the Gormans are so far out of reach due to their wealth that it's interesting to talk about because we don't know them, says Holly Anderson, assistant director of Camden's Park and Recreation Committee and one-time local news reporter. We don't run into them on a regular basis at French and Braun and at the park and at the polls and at the coffee shops. We don't go to church with them, so they're very easy to talk about. Are they embarrassed? Wonders Barbara Spalding, a 65-year-old neighbor who grew up spending a couple weeks each year at her family's summer cottage on the point and who now lives year-round in Camden. Do they feel badly? Are they regretting their decision? Did they look back and think, ugh, this view was not worth it? Martin told the Globe that he fielded calls from as far as Florida. You gotta nail those people. I get why people here care so much, he told the paper, but I don't understand why I'm getting calls from all over. Everybody's like, oh, these jet-setting political dynasty people, says McKellar. All the nuance of, maybe there's another side of the story, is so tiring for everybody, she goes on. People seem to be so thrilled to have something that's like, are these people definitely evil? Both Gorman and the Bonds are often described as private, though the local impression of Gorman, whose primary residence is in nearby Yarmouth, is almost universally positive. She's a wonderful neighbor, and everyone in town thinks very highly of her, says Haley McKinnon, who lives across the street from Gorman's Camden cul-de-sac. Gorman occasionally makes the main news for her disbursement of grants and other charitable gifts. An endowed scholarship for community college students in the state set up by the Gorman's children, a $4 million gift to Maine Medical Center. According to Federal Election Commission data, she regularly contributes to Democratic funds at the state and federal level. L.L. Bean is arguably the largest and most successful consumer exporter of vacation land charm, bringing Maine vibes to the masses since Leon Wood Bean founded the company in 1912 as a purveyor of hunting boots. In 1980, the official preppy handbook dubbed it the biggest seller of the rugged New England prep look. Today, the company is a one-stop shop for fishing poles and hunting accessories, but also the duck boot, the boat and tote, percale comforter covers printed with lobsters, and wool blankets emblazoned with the state's original pine tree flag. The company's three boatmobiles, 13-foot-high, 20-foot-long aluminum and fiberglass replicas of the iconic brown boot built onto GMC Sierras, have reportedly covered more than 350,000 miles and visited 25 states. One made an appearance at last summer's Portland Pride Parade. It was Leon Bean's grandson, the former Navy man Leon Gorman, who turned the company from a $2.25 million local venture into a $1.61 billion outdoor lifestyle juggernaut. In 2014, WealthX, an international wealth intelligence firm, named him Maine's richest person, worth $840 million. When Leon Gorman died in 2015, the flagship Freeport store, famously open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, shut its doors for 4 hours, its first voluntary closure in 48 years. Lisa Gorman really understands what it means to be a neighbor, and a Mainer, more importantly, says McKinnon. And that could not be further from the Bonds. It is the ultimate exercise in contrast. Reporters leaned into that disparity. Like other wealthy summer residents who have been building or buying big houses here for more than a century, the Gormans were attracted to Camden's serene beauty and proximity to both the sea and mountains, wrote Kevin Cullen for The Globe. They bought their waterfront home in 2002. The Bonds paid $1.8 million for theirs in 2018. Next photo, Silence of the Saplings. Camden Harbor, a scene from the Bond property. And yet, Amelia Bond and Lisa Gorman, on paper at least, are more alike than not. Arthur Bond III may have contributed to his uncle's Senate campaigns in the 1990s, but the only available FEC data from either Bond since then are multiple donations by Amelia Bond to the Kamala Harris campaign and Act Blue. And the Bonds' introduction to Camden actually came years earlier than their 2018 home purchase. According to property records, Amelia Bond's father, William Irvin Jack, a former finance attorney turned Colorado rancher and conservationist who died at age 86 in 2021 in Portland, Maine, purchased the place on Bayview Street with his wife, Lynn, Amelia's stepmother, in 2005. 2 years later, Amelia and Arthur bought a house down the block from a couple called McCullies, who were friends of Lynn. The Bonds dubbed their 32-foot boat, built in 2001, with a hailing port of Camden, the Wanderin. And the bungalow, logically Dunwanderin. In 2018, the Bonds bought from the McCullies again, this time purchasing 1 Metcalf Road. The move got the Bonds significantly closer to the waterfront, and for much of the year, when the trees were bare, they had a fairly unobstructed view. But in the glorious summer months, the foliage created a natural screen. We have various scales of ocean view, Camden's town assessor, Carrie Leichtman, tells me a few hours after visiting the Bonds property during the town revaluation. We have obstructed view, obstructed seasonal view, average ocean view, good ocean view, very good ocean view, panoramic ocean view. Each of these is affiliated with an influence factor, which serves as a multiplier when assessing property value. The Bonds' 12,362-square-foot parcel, prior to the tree removal, qualified as a good view and had a land value of just shy of $1.2 million. After the herbicide application and remediation, which cleared a significant view of the water, Leichtman has assessed the property as having a very good view, adding almost $500,000 to its value. Gorman's place, being right on the water, is in a whole other class, oceanfront too. It is difficult to overstate the rabid desire an ocean view can incite in Camden, with trees often winding up as collateral damage. In one 2016 instance, when a couple removed a tree near their property line shortly after moving into their new 690,000 house on Harbor Road, one of the abutting property owners had an ominous message for them. "In this neighborhood," she said, as reported by the Portland Press Herald, "we don't do any cutting without discussing it with the neighbors first." That woman promptly contacted the same landscaper the neighbor had used, Camden's a small town, to plant a row of pines and arborvitae, which, per the lawsuit the couple subsequently filed, constituted a Maine statutory spite fence that obscured their view of Camden Harbor. The case eventually landed before the Maine Supreme Court, which upheld the lower court's ruling in the new couple's favor. The court ordered their neighbor to remove several trees and trim the arborvitae to 10 feet or less, and to add a restriction to the property deed that would hold future owners to the same rules. 3 years earlier, in neighboring Rockport, one man allegedly waited until his neighbors left town on vacation before hiring someone to remove a span of their trees, plus 40 feet of fencing, to improve his own ocean view. That ensuing lawsuit ended in a $50,000 settlement agreement. In the early 2000s, Lisa Gorman herself was involved in a separate, quieter neighborly dispute. According to multiple people who recall the incident, her then-next-door neighbor noticed that five of the mature weeping willows growing on his side of the property line had been cut down. When he raised this with Gorman, she suggested he call her lawyer. Rather than go to court, the two parties agreed that Gorman would replant the space with trees of her choosing. A source close to Gorman says, years ago, an inadvertent mistake concerning a property line was made by a landscaper who promptly took care of the problem to everyone's satisfaction. Unfortunately, we learned that the herbicide poison applied by Arthur and Amelia Bond has now spread into our Lake Beach Park in Camden Harbor, the Select Board wrote in their 2024 annual report, published in June. We remain committed to rectifying this situation by all means for the safety of all of us and doing everything we can to make sure it never happens again, including working with our law enforcement agencies. 2 months earlier, Sevian Marr presented a report to the town detailing trace levels of alligator found in samples from test bores at the beach and park, above laboratory reporting limits, but below EPA residential and protection of groundwater exposure risk guidelines. Although what has been detected may appear to be within the EPA's standards for risk, the state of Maine does not have a standard for this herbicide, says Martin. Among locals, there remains suspicion of adverse effects. Last February, McKinnon and her partner, Will Addis, lost their 10-year-old terrier to liver and kidney failure. He was perfectly healthy, 10 years old, before we moved here, says McKinnon. We moved here the year that Amelia Bond started applying this pesticide, and we took him down to that beach all the time. It's really hard for me not to draw some kind of connection. Addis interjects with a fact check. We don't know that. Last year, a beloved red oak in the public park toppled over following gale force winds. Martin doesn't believe the two events are connected. Out of curiosity, McKellar wants the tree tested for tebutherion. To residents, the herbicide on Lake Beach feels personal. If you don't own an oceanfront property in Camden, says Hedstrom, you only have a few places that you really have great access to the ocean, and that's one of them. Still, the herbicide is just one of many threats to the beach, which consistently ranks among Maine's most polluted and frequently test positive for high levels of enterococci bacteria, an increase scientists link to sea temperature rise. The expanding population of this story's itchy red herrings, the brown-tail moths, has also been linked to climate change. In a 13-month period, reads the 2024 town report, Camden experienced five FEMA-declared disaster events that caused damage from high winds, overland flooding in our watersheds, and coastal flooding that fundamentally changed much of the eastern seaboard of the United States. The storms left Gorman's own stairs down to Lake Beach in disarray, and the enormous granite public steps as mangled as the mouth of a person who just had their teeth punched in. The herbicide incident coincided with other rapid shifts, the pandemic and the influx of new residents and the turnover of new people really fundamentally changed the community, says Kaler, the town manager. Even though the two groups of residents who were at the heart of this issue were here prior to the pandemic, it spotlighted a lot of these changes and tensions. According to the New York Times, since the pandemic, Maine has had the seventh highest in-migration rate in the country, and in 2021 was the only state where the median age declined from the year prior. Camden officials say that one consistent reason they hear from people for their move to Maine is rising temperatures elsewhere in the country. Certain newcomers spend most of their lives elsewhere. Reserving seaside Camden for the year's hottest months. Some people embrace the part-time residence, And some people can't raise their middle finger high enough, says Lichtman, Camden's assessor. There are, he says, fiscal benefits to having so many partial year residents, including that they pay taxes without using public services year-round. But they also drive up property values, making it doubly difficult for people who work in Camden, at the schools, in the service industry, as caretakers for those very vacation homes to find a place to live. In Camden's 2024 revaluation, we're adding about $700 million of value to the town, says Lichtman. The real estate market changed that much. Hedstrom and other community members have sent emails to the Maine Attorney General and to their district attorney requesting prosecution. In response, Scott Boak, Assistant AG, Chief of Natural Resources Division, noted the substantial remuneration already paid by the bonds. We will consider all of this information and the underlying situation carefully, he wrote, in consultation with the BPC, DEP, and other interested state agencies, as we consider your request related to further enforcement. When reached for comment by Vanity Fair, the Maine Attorney General's press liaison responds, I cannot confirm or deny the existence of any investigation. In order to prosecute a case, I would need a police investigation, Natasha Irving, DA for Maine's Prosecutorial District 6, which includes Knox County, wrote to the Select Board on February 29, 2024. I can look into this. By July, she let Hedstrom know that she was declining to pursue criminal charges, and the correspondence soured. One concerned citizen emailed Irving, copying Hedstrom and others, outlining statutes she believed relevant, from criminal mischief, which carries a penalty of up to 5 years in prison and a fine of up to $5,000, she wrote, to other charges associated with environmental protection laws. In following emails, Irving responded that Bond's admission to applying the herbicide was not an admission to intentionally destroying the property of another, and that the tree valuation under Maine law is low, making a felony conviction unlikely. I understand that you and members of the community want the bonds to be held criminally liable, she wrote to Hedstrom and other officials. Conduct can be appalling and abhorrent, and still not provable as a crime. It shouldn't be something that you can just pay your way out of, Hedstrom says. One of the things that I think is important is for people to accept responsibility for their actions, show remorse, be willing to answer hard questions, and apologize. The bonds sincerely regret these circumstances and the unintended consequences that were created, the couple's lawyer said in a statement he sent to Vanity Fair. They have expressed remorse and have consistently taken steps to address this situation, and they will continue to cooperate with the parties given the seriousness of the allegations. People make mistakes. They do things that are selfish, do things that cause harm, and they don't even realize they're doing it. Both Hedstrom and McKellar have experienced the worst kind of this butterfly effect. McKellar had served on the Select Board for less than a year when her younger sister, 32-year-old Kristen, went swimming with a friend in Damariscotta Lake, 40 minutes out of town. At dusk, McKellar tells me in the clipped tone of someone who has had to repeat a horrible fact, she was hit by a motorboat and died. The boat's driver, a Massachusetts resident, was indicted for reckless operation of a watercraft, operating a watercraft at an imprudent speed, and manslaughter. When Irving became district attorney, she dropped the manslaughter charge under a deferred disposition agreement, meaning a court-postponed sentencing contingent on the accused fulfilling certain conditions. And in 2019, the man pleaded guilty only to the reckless operation charge in exchange for 100 hours of community service and a $400 fine. In 2021, he was arrested again in Maine, this time for allegedly driving 99 miles per hour in a 70-mile-per-hour zone on I-95 and operating a vehicle under the influence. with a blood alcohol level nearly twice the legal limit. He received a now-deferred disposition agreement that included 21 days in jail. Hedstrom originally ran for his seat after a fire in a building without a certificate of occupancy killed one of his sons, 14-year-old Theodore. Racked with grief and frustrated by what he saw as systemic failures and a lack of code enforcement that may have prevented Theodore's death, "I ran for the board because I wanted to make a difference in this community," Hedstrom says. "I wanted to show people that you can make changes within the system." Has anything changed in Camden? Representative Vicky Dudera, a local real estate agent currently serving her third term in the Maine House of Representatives, is planning to propose legislation that will increase penalties for misuse of herbicides and pesticides and to address intent. And in August, at a select board meeting, Martin drafted a proposed notification and reporting code that would require licensed applicators, arborists, lawn companies, etc., to notify abutting neighbors and the town of Camden in advance of application, as well as annual reports of applications of herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers used in town. In November, Camden residents voted overwhelmingly in favor of adding the new chapter to the Camden Code. Amelia Bond's actions wouldn't have fallen under this ordinance, since by her own account she elected to apply the herbicide herself. Last 4th of July, while a group of locals perched on the seawall near Late Beach, getting ready to watch the fireworks, potentially Camden's last display, another recent topic of select board debate, according to one person there, an apron-clad private chef emerged from the house of a remote local millionaire bearing, rather than request to clear out, a basket lined in a red checkered cloth, brimming with cookies and brownies to disperse. At Late Beach and Park, monitoring will continue biannually through next fall, which means that 2 years in, Martin and other town officials have continued to meet with the Bonds attorneys to draw up further agreements. They clearly want to continue to cooperate with the town and resolve this situation. "I don't think this is probably good for them," Martin says. "I think what they really need is, what's the end? Can we continue this forever?" And I understand that. For now, they're drawing up an interim memorandum to cover further liability for the continued monitoring, which thus far comes to an estimated $40,000. In August, Hedstrom resigned as chairman to spend more time with his son, who lives in Europe, but remains on the select board, which continues to meet twice a month, every month, to discuss the town's issues. And through the seasons, a baseball hat has remained on display in the window of Symmetry, a shop in town, broadcasting a mantra, "More trees, less bullshit." Thank you. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.